It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. The United States is relaxing a number of restrictions on travel, trade, and banking with Cuba starting today. It is part of President Obama's effort to normalize relations with Cuba, which has been under a U.S. embargo for more than a half century. White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
The new measures announced by senior U.S. officials Thursday make it easier for Americans to travel to Cuba for humanitarian and religious work and to help Cuban citizens set up small businesses. The embargo remains in place, and the United States will still not allow Americans to go as tourists. The new rules are part of Mr. Obama's plan to normalize relations with Cuba. Ties have been severed for more than five decades after Fidel Castro seized power, confiscated private property, and established a communist totalitarian system. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Two suspects were killed and a third captured in a Belgian counterterrorism operation in the eastern town of Verviers on Thursday. It is close to the German border. Special Magistrate Eric van der Sijp says the suspects had automatic weapons and there was an intense firefight.
During the search warrant in Verviers, certain suspects immediately opened fire with automatic weapons at special forces of the police. They opened fire during several minutes before being neutralized.
Van der Sijp says there was no established link to last week's terror attacks in Paris that left 17 people dead. Prosecutors say the suspects in Belgium are on the verge of a major terrorist strike in the country, aimed primarily at police stations. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Paris, showing solidarity with the French people in the wake of last week's terrorist attacks in Paris. Secretary Kerry says he wants to express the affection of the American people for France. The White House admitted it made a mistake by not sending a high-level representative to a massive anti-terrorism march in Paris last Sunday that attracted many world leaders.
Et ce sont les musulmans qui sont les premières victimes du fanatisme.
French President François Hollande says mainstream Muslims are the primary victims of fanaticism, fundamentalism, and intolerance. Mr. Hollande spoke at the Arab World Institute in Paris Thursday, which seeks to build closer ties between France and Arab cultures. Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan made a surprise visit to northeastern Borno State, the center of the Boko Haram insurgency. Mr. Jonathan, who is campaigning for re-election, flew to Borno State's capital of Maiduguri Thursday, where he spoke with troops at an army barracks and met with hundreds of civilians displaced from Baga, a town captured by the insurgents earlier this month. Massive flooding in Malawi has killed at least 48 people and left about 70,000 others homeless. Many are reported missing. Malawi's President Peter Mutharika declared a state of emergency in much of the country. Mozambique's new president, Filipe Nyusi, was sworn in Thursday in the capital city, Maputo, at a ceremony attended by thousands of people. But members of the opposition Renamo Party boycotted the ceremony to protest last year's vote, which they call fraudulent. Pope Francis received a roaring welcome to the Philippines on Thursday as he began a five-day visit to Asia's largest Roman Catholic country. Thousands of people lined the streets of Manila cheering for him as the Pope's convoy drove by. Indonesian Navy divers will try again today to retrieve bodies from the main section of the AirAsia flight that crashed last month into the Java Sea. Divers were unable to work Thursday because of bad weather and rough seas. All 162 people aboard the Airbus were killed. 50 bodies have been recovered. U.S. boxing great Muhammad Ali was hospitalized Thursday for the second time in 4 weeks. He's been given follow-up care related to a urinary tract infection that first put him in the hospital last month. The three-time world heavyweight champion was admitted to an undisclosed hospital, and a family spokesman says the boxing legend is in stable condition. Ali is expected to be released today in time for his birthday on Saturday when he turns 73. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mozambique's main opposition party wants dialogue to ease tension in the country.
Our expectation is that he open room for discussion with the Renamo leadership so to find a peaceful settlement of this political dispute that we are on at this moment.
Eduardo Namburete is head of RENAMO's external relations. What's causing the frequent collapse of buildings in Kenya? South Sudan faces serious economic challenges in the midst of a civil war and falling oil prices. And Sudan's main opposition party faces dissolution for signing an agreement with rebels.
We are mobilizing our grassroots all over Sudan to reject this unfair and unconstitutional move by the NIS and the NCP.
Mariam El Mardi is the vice president of Sudan's main opposition, Umar Party. Muslim clerics in Cameroon get IT training to use against Boko Haram. And the New York Times endorses Zimbabwe as one of the best tourist destinations in 2015. Those stories plus Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mozambique's main opposition RENAMO party says it is willing to hold peace negotiations with newly installed President Filipe Nyusi. The goal is to ease political tensions in the country after RENAMO rejected the outcome of last October's general election. Mr. Nyusi was officially installed as Mozambican president yesterday, Thursday, but the opposition RENAMO boycotted the event, citing voter fraud during the poll. Eduardo Namburete, the head of RENAMO's external relations, tells reporter Peter Clotty that his party will only accept Mr. Nyusi's legitimacy after the leader acknowledges that the election was marred by voter irregularities.
The ceremony that was witnessed today, under normal circumstances, should have not been held, because signing in ceremony, it should be a conclusion of a fair and transparent electoral process where all Mozambicans would feel represented by this single person who will lead the country for the next 5 years. But as we know, the elections that were held in Mozambique were not fair, were not free, were not transparent. And as such, the one who was declared the winner is not representing truly the will of the people of Mozambique.
Are you willing, is your party willing, to hold talks with the new president to ease tension? Because they are suggesting that members of your party could possibly take up arms against the government.
Now that he was formally invested with the power as the president, our expectation is that he opened room for discussion with the Renamo leadership so to find a peaceful settlement of this political dispute that we are on at this moment. It is our hope that in the next few days, Mr. Nyusi may open room for that discussion to start.
But Mr. Namburete, if you expect this new president to open dialogue with your party, RENAMO, to resolve any possible differences between you, why wouldn't you accept him as the legitimate president as part of the process to move this dialogue forward?
Well, our recognition, it will depend on his willingness to understand that the process was not conducted in a fair manner. If he shows that openness and acknowledges that things didn't go well, then we may also recognize him as the president and engage in a discussion to reach a common ground, to reach a peaceful settlement. As of now, he has not mentioned, he has not given any indication. It's soon, yes, but we are expecting that in the next few days or hours, he may show that sign. And if the discussion starts, then there's room for us to acknowledge and recognize him as the head of state, if he also acknowledged that the process was not conducted in a fair manner. That is the only way I think we can reach a common ground and take the country to move on a peaceful track.
Eduardo Namburete is the head of RENAMO's external relations. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. Sudan's largest opposition party, the National Umar Party, said it will oppose by all means necessary an attempt by the country's National Intelligence and Security Services, known as NAS, to have the party frozen or dissolved. In a complaint to Sudan's Political Parties Council, the agency said Umar Party leader Sadiq al-Mahdi violated Sudan's interim constitution and Political Parties Act of 2007 when he signed the Paris Declaration with rebels who are fighting against President Omar al-Bashir government. The agency asked the council to give the Umar Party 1 week to respond or be frozen or dissolved. Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi, vice president of the Umar Party, said her organization will use legal, political, and international pressure to reject what she called an unconstitutional move.
Of course, it's nonsensical and it's not appropriate, but we believe this is part of the coming period now in Sudan. The so-called constitutional amendments that took place a week earlier, it is a second coup in Sudan, reinforcing the totalitarian regime and giving the president of NCP, the ruling party, the full power over everything. And actually, it's a total letting go of any decentralization or democratic transformation or rule of law.
Madam, the National Intelligence and Security Services is saying that your party should be dissolved because you violated part of the Constitution, meaning that you signed the so-called Paris Declaration, which calls for the dismantling of the one-party system in Sudan and a total change of government. So do you understand where they are coming from?
Actually, now this represents in itself the most strong violation to the constitution of Sudan, because now it's an orderly force after it was supposed to be a service that is following or being directly under the president, so it cannot be accountable to any structure. And they are now taking the missions of SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, and the Sudanese police. So they represent this violation. Regarding their accusation, actually, if there is any sane rulers in Sudan, we should have been praised for this signing, because the signing was basically doing a total change in Sudan, which we have addressed it even with the NCP themselves, that there is a need for change, because Sudan now is a failing state in economics, in politics, and with widespread conflicts all over Sudan, in all parts of Sudan.
The deputy chairman of your party, Falala Berman, said that you are going to pursue legal and other political means. So what chance do you have? Can you go to court in Sudan?
The lawyers of Umma Party believe it's important to exhaust the legal mechanisms of Sudan. That's why they are going ahead and they are starting by responding to the memorandum of the political party's memo. But we don't expect much out of that. That's why we are also addressing the international mechanisms of justice, like the African Court of Human and People's Rights, as well as the Islamic League mechanisms.
Mariam al-Mahdi is the vice president of Sudan's main opposition Umar Party. She was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 16, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. An American professor who follows events in Sudan and South Sudan says the two countries are facing serious economic challenges. Eric Reeves says Juba has run out of cash and that ordinary people are struggling to put food on the table. He says the South Sudan civil war has affected oil fields in Unity and Upper Nile states. He says the report on the cost of war in South Sudan has regional implications.
It's terrifying in its implications. This is a region that cannot afford $50 billion or whatever the amount might be of continued warfare. It's just absurd that money would be devoted to war rather than to reconstructing South Sudan, to alleviating suffering by the people of South Sudan and by other people in the region.
One of the recommendations of the report is that the African Union and other regional actors should put a contingency plan to see to it that this conflict in South Sudan is put to an end. Do you subscribe to that conclusion?
What we need a single set of diplomatic auspices, and if that means IGAD, but IGAD with assistance from the African Union, from perhaps the Troika, Norway, the U.S., and the U.K., we're starting to see a proliferation of venues, and that's bad. That's always bad. What we need is a single venue, a single set of auspices, and a really, really determined set of negotiators who, if it comes to that, will arbitrate, won't merely facilitate, but will arbitrate and dictate the terms of a resolution. Both parties have now moved into a phase in which they need a very, very strong push.
A question that a lot of people want an answer to is, where does South Sudan get its money to sustain this war?
Well, I think we're seeing that it's starting to run out of money. First, the Unity oil fields shut down. Now the Upper Nile oil fields are working at about half capacity. And oil is at an all-time low for the past decade, I think. That means that there's very little money coming into the treasury. There are some ways in which South Sudan can borrow money, but not for long. And we're already seeing increases in fuel and food prices, especially in Juba and the surrounding areas. This is going to explode as the South Sudanese currency continues to fall in value. And at a certain point, if there's no foreign exchange currency, there will be no way for South Sudan to import anything it needs. It will be wholly reliant on humanitarian assistance.
Eric Reeves is a Sudan researcher and analyst and a professor of English literature at Smith College in Massachusetts. He was speaking with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. Muslim clerics, traditional rulers, and dignitaries from Cameroon's northern border areas with Nigeria have assembled in Yaoundé to be trained in communication technologies and the internet in order to share information with the military as part of strategies to combat the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Most of the 100 Muslim clerics and traditional rulers assembled here at the Yaoundé African Institute of Computer Studies are touching a keyboard for the first time. Laminu Nana, an imam from Fotokol, along the border with Nigeria's Borno State, says he does not know how to read and write, which makes this training that much harder. I think they should have invited our children because this thing is difficult for us, he says. Noting he finds this course very complicated. Modibo Alidu from the Ashigashia Mosque, which straddles the Nigeria-Cameroon border, says he's eager to learn more after day two of intensive classes. He says he's learned how to switch his computer on and lock it off, but he is interested in sending messages and pictures. He's calling on all imams and Muslim leaders to study how to make use of the internet so as to be connected. Trainer Sheikh Umaru Malam says Muslim leaders in general need to get up to speed with IT and its impact on daily life in their communities. But he notes this specific course is designed to teach those in areas which have been targets of attacks and kidnappings by the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. He says being able to share critical information quickly is essential to help authorities identify and locate terrorist suspects.
This training is going to enable imams and Muslim dignitaries to be able to work, to communicate with others. They are going to be not only in communication with those who are around them, but they are going to communicate and to cooperate with the world to spread peace, harmony between mankind.
Dr. Musa Umaru, president of the Cameroon Council of Imams and Muslim Dignitaries, says his group helped design the digital training for computers and mobile phones, and it has been used by the government as a tool in the fight against Boko Haram attacks in the north. He says establishing peace does not involve only the use of weapons, and that is why during their third conference of imams and Muslim dignitaries, they decided to collaborate with the government in fighting against Boko Haram. He says no one can be effective in today's world without some mastery of information technologies. Moki, Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The recent collapse of two buildings in Kenya's capital has raised concerns about building safety in the country. Government regulators have been making the rounds to inspect construction sites. But as VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports, corruption continues to plague the industry.
In building after building, town after town, inspectors from Kenya's National Construction Authority are leaving their mark and shutting down unsafe building sites across the country. In a nationwide audit, the NCA says it has shut down 500 sites since August, sometimes for safety violations, sometimes after finding substandard building materials. Here in the town of Kitengela, outside Nairobi, engineer Crispus Andino discovers violations wherever he looks.
They don't have any clothing, no helmet. I see this particular worker, even the eyes, they are very red. You can see their eyes are very red. This means this worker, even the hands, is operating an environment that's very unsafe, very unhealthy.
Buildings are going up so fast across Kenya, national regulators can hardly keep up. When they find illegal activity, they order construction stopped and sometimes tear down the building.
So at the moment, we are going to stop the construction of this particular site.
Building safety is on everyone's minds following recent accidents. Earlier this month, a woman and small child died when this seven-story building collapsed in Huruma Estate, Nairobi. 2 weeks earlier, seven people were killed in a separate collapse in Makongeni. Police Inspector General Samuel Arachi says those responsible could face criminal charges.
For this incident, everybody was involved in the construction, right from the engineers, the architects, the contractor and the owner. To us, this is criminal negligence and it will not be condoned.
Past building collapses have all taken place in the city's poorest neighborhoods, where buildings go up quickly with little supervision. Health hazards from poor ventilation or open sewer lines also create dangerous conditions for tenants. Architecture professor Alfred Omenya says regulators are often paid to look the other way.
There's a big issue, there's a big elephant in the room, the corruption, that even when these people are there, they're able to allow a whole lot of substandard practices, a whole lot of illegal practices, because, of course, they're actually able to extort bribes and they're not serious about, doing their work.
The anti-corruption group Transparency International ranked land services in Kenya, which would include the construction authority, as the second most corrupt sector of government, just behind the police. The country has promised to increase inspections of construction sites and existing housing, particularly in Nairobi, in hopes of preventing another deadly disaster. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The renowned New York Times newspaper has endorsed Zimbabwe as one of the best tourist destinations this year. Zimbabwe placed 14th on the list with Milan, Cuba, Philadelphia, Yellowstone National Park and El Kei Valley in Chile claiming the top five spots. The paper said it gathers ideas from its contributing writers in various parts of the world. Zimbabwe's Minister of Tourism, Walter Mzembe, has embraced his country's inclusion on the list, saying his ministry has been working hard to attract tourists.
It's an endorsement of brand Zimbabwe. Coming as it does on the back of a very successful 2013 when we hosted the UNWTO General Assembly, the 20th session, which was attended by excess of 144 countries, over 50 ministerial representations, 400 media, 800 affiliate organizations. Arguably the most successful General Assembly in the UNWTO family since the inception of the General Assemblies. So I think it registered with the world that we are a peaceful destination, secure, with a very attractive product. as it were.
How would you characterize the tourism industry at the moment?
Well, we've just broken the 2 million barrier. I'm signposting a 5 billion tourism economy by the year 2020, 5 million arrivals, cent contribution to GDP. What I popularly dub here as the 5-5-15-2020 vision for the tourism sector.
Countries like the United States are heavily reliant on local tourism. Is that something that you are encouraging as the minister? And are there any incentives for local tourists?
It is tourism that is going to be the catalyst for economic recovery. Because with minimum but significant investment, we can position it to basically provide the much-needed cash flow in the economy. And what it takes is to receive visitors, give them a good experience that will make them retain again. How do we get there? We must facilitate the accessibility of our destination.
Zimbabwe Tourism Minister Walter Mzembe was speaking from Harare with Untungamile Nkumo of VOA's Zimbabwe service. This time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Rwanda's national team coach, Steven Constantine, has resigned. The Rwanda Football Federation spokesman, Musa Hakizimana, told the Kigali media on Thursday night. According to Hakizimana, coach Constantine has opted for a second stint as coach of the Indian national football team. Constantine is credited with guiding Rwanda's Amavubi to improve to 68th place from the 134th spot on the FIFA ranking. This is Rwanda's highest placing on the FIFA rankings in the country's football history. In the United Arab Emirates, Ivory Coast lost 2-0 to Sweden in their last Orange Africa Cup of Nations build-up match played in Dubai on Thursday. Tomorrow, Saturday, African champions Nigeria Super Eagles wind up their tour of the United Arab Emirates with a match against Yemen in Dubai. Yemen is a late replacement after Sudan pulled out of the tie at the last minute. Earlier on, the African champions went down 1-0 to the Ivory Coast in Dubai. Moving on to Equatorial Guinea. Hosts Equatorial Guinea play the Republic of Congo before Burkina Faso engage Gabon in Group A action in Bata at the start of the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations tomorrow Saturday. On Sunday, attention shifts to Group B in Ebebiyin, which is in the northeast corner of the country. Zambia lock horns with the Democratic Republic of Congo, then Tunisia face Cape Verde Islands. In cricket, hosts Namibia play Kenya in the opening match of the 2015 ICC World Cricket League Division 2 in Windhoek tomorrow Saturday. Netherlands engage Canada as Nepal tackle Uganda in the day's other matches. On Sunday, Namibia face Uganda. Nepal challenge Netherlands as Kenya encounter Canada. The week-long round-robin contest is a qualification pathway towards the 2019 Cricket World Cup. Finally, in horse racing, Kenya hosts a Four Nations International Jockey Challenge in Ngong on the outskirts of the capital Nairobi on Sunday. Teams from Mauritius, South Africa, Zimbabwe and hosts Kenya compete in 9 races and 6 challenge events. The competition is being staged to mark 110 years of horse racing in Kenya. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We'll see you on Monday. And that's it for this Friday, January 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butter saying, have a lovely weekend, Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I judge. This one I judge.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. right here on VOA Africa.